Scripture readings today are from Book of Job 42 and also from Mark 16. I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now, therefore, take seven bulls and seven rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has done. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Namathite went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then there came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and they ate bread with him in his house. They showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him, and each of them gave him a piece of money and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, and he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He named the first Jeremiah, the second Keziah, and the third Keren-Hapush. In all the land, there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance along with their brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his children's children 4 generations. And Job died old and full of days. And the second scripture reading is from Mark chapter 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb? When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And all the happenings of them they told briefly to those around Peter. And afterward, Jesus himself sent out through them from east to west the sacred and imperishable proclamation of eternal salvation. That was the shorter ending of Mark chapter 6, and this is the longer version. Now, after he rose early on the day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom they cast out 7 demons. She went out and told those who had been with him while they were alive. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it. After this, appeared two of them as they were walking into the country. And they went back and told the rest. They did not believe them. Later, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were sitting at the table, and he upbraided them for their lack of faith and stubbornness, because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen. And he said to them, go all unto the world and proclaim the good news to the whole creation. The one who believes and is baptized, but the one who does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will accompany those who believe. By using my name, they will cast out demons, and they will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes in their hands, and if they drink any deadly thing, it will not hurt them. They will lay their hands on the sick, and they will recover. So then the Lord Jesus, after he had spoken, was taken up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. And they went out and proclaimed the good news everywhere, while the Lord with them and confirmed the message by the signs that accompanied it. Thus ends the reading.
Hi, everybody. I'm Irene. I'm the pastor for Kahanaokeakua out in Waianae. I'm here at the church. And we, for the last 5 weeks since we started doing quarantine, have been going over the Book of Job. It's kind of a weird book to be going over during Easter. I understand that. So I wanted to address that. First of all, Job is very near and dear to my heart. If there is a book that I consider myself to be an expert on, that I love with all my soul, it's Job. Job taught me how to be a Christian. It taught me how to be a human being. I found it in a very dark time in my life. I have a William Blake rendition of Job tattooed on my leg. So lucky you that you get to hear the end of my sermon series on Job. I'll do a little bit of a recap for those of you who haven't been walking on our Job journey, our Easter Job journey. So as we come to a close, because this is our closing week of Job, I want to acknowledge that it does seem odd that I've chosen to cover this particular book because it's centered on suffering during a traditional time of joy. Because we often think of the Easter season as being joyful and renewal and not all the suffering and boils and plague and death that comes with Job. But despite that, I think Job is a super pertinent book to be discussing for that exact reason. I think that this book is really pertinent to the strange time of pandemic, social distancing, death, and financial chaos that we're surrounded in, especially because of Eastertide, not in spite of it. Indeed, as we see, from Jesus' suffering and death on a cross that lead into his resurrection, difficult times are often necessary for redemptive times. Hope arises from the precursor of loss. Darkness exists only because of its relationship to light. So perhaps Job wasn't such an odd choice of sermon series for Easter through a pandemic after all, because darkness and light have a relationship. So that's why we're doing Job, is because we're in the middle of a crazy time in all of our lives, in the middle of Easter, which looked totally different than all of us wanted it to. And so let's talk about Job. So I want to do a short recap to where we've been that brings us to our suffering friend saga that ends here in chapter 42. So I started this sermon series with chapter 6, mostly because I think that this chapter best encapsulates the feeling that is found in the bulk of Job's relentless cries. He says in chapter 6, "What is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should be patient?" That's Job 6:11. These were the words that sort of came to me in prayer as we prepared to enter this time of unknown, this time that was very scary for many of us and continues to be, because we know that it'll be damaging to our economy. We know that it could threaten our very health and our lives. There's so many things at stake that were not 2 months ago. So Job came to me and said, "To what is the end? To when should I be patient?" So that's why we're talking about him. These days are dark ones of uncertainty and confusion, in which the echo of hopeless cries of Job will keep asking when this madness will end. Like Job in chapter 6, we have yet to know the answer to that question. So from chapter 6, we stepped backwards into Job chapter 1. So Job chapter 1 is sort of like our current chapter that we're talking about in our study, Job chapter 42, because it's widely considered to be a redaction. Now, a redaction is a fancy theology word that means an edit long removed from the original writing. Redaction. We're going to use this word a lot today. So I'm going to say it again. It is an edit that is long removed from the original writing, especially pertaining to the Bible. So structurally, Job, and the reason why they think it's a redaction is because structurally, Job chapters 1 and 42 do not follow the poetic format used in most of the book. Also, in terms of content, chapters 1 and 42 offer explanations to Job's suffering that is counter. It's not the same as the rest of the messaging in the book. For example, God and Job both reprimand Job's friends for attempting to explain suffering into a neat little package. A lot of the book in which Job and God are talking, it reprimands his friends for saying, "Well, there's a reason for your suffering. There's a reason this happened. God has a reason why he does everything." God and Job are like, "No, I did nothing wrong. There's no reason why this should have happened." Yet chapters 1 and 42 still try to offer an explanation, even though the rest of the book doesn't. So they think it's a redaction because the message is different. The content is different. The way that it's written is different. So clearly, chapter 41 and 42 were written at a different time, probably later than Job 1. So we moved on to chapter 38 last week. This is last week. We're almost there. Almost caught up. Sorry. Getting there. But we moved to chapter 38, in which God finally responds to Job's 36 previous chapters of crying out in terrible agony and refusing to be subdued. God responds in chapter 38, and it may seem unnecessarily antagonistic at first glance. I want to do my best God voice. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of earth? tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. That's Job chapter 42, verses 4 through 5. That's the same voice that I use to read Where the Wild Things Are to my kids, by the way. So I guess God and Where the Wild Things Are, same voice. Anyway, so God's response to Job, it seems at first like he is antagonizing Job, like, you don't know nothing, kid. But actually, what we discussed last week is that God's response is an invitation to view the world in its magnificent glory. When we stand on a mountain and look out over the vast expanse of ocean, or we celebrate the new baby born into a family that loves that baby, or the myriad of other miracles that God created in this world, we are reminded of the majesty and our place within it, beyond the valley of darkness and tragedy. We are reminded that light is stronger than darkness. The vastness of God's greatness provides hope for Job in this chapter, not antagonization. So, catching up. So today I want to talk today more about the redaction. Again, a word meaning a long removed edit from the original writing. We're going to talk more about the redaction in the closing chapter of Job. I chose Mark chapter 16 to correspond to this reading from Job because Job 42 and Mark 16 are actually very similar in redaction format. Both of these books have been redacted at the end. Mark's version of Jesus' death and resurrection are the first written accounts of these events in the Gospels as we have them today. Mark was actually written before Matthew, but Matthew comes first in our Bibles, probably because Mark comes off as a little bit pushy and kind of mean. So maybe the editors of the Bible just kind of like shuffled in behind Matthew. I don't know. There's probably a better explanation than that. Whatever the reason, it's important to know that Mark came first. Mark came first in terms of the biblical gospels because Jesus' resurrection story is actually a redaction in Mark's gospel. The first account of Easter Sunday does not end in hope and abounding glory. It says so much right there in the text that it's a redaction. They're terrified, they're confused, and then it just stops, right? The original ending to Mark is filled with terror and confusion at the sight of the empty tomb, and that's where it just stops, right? Mark was being written as the world was literally falling apart around the disciples. Mark was being written as the world was falling apart around them. The temple has been destroyed and the Roman armies have invaded the city and they killed nearly everyone. Mark's entire gospel is written in panic mode and then it ends in panic mode. Instead of ending his gospel with Jesus reuniting with his friends and leaving words of peace and assurance to carry them on their paths before he reascends into a cloud and at Pentecost, that doesn't happen in the original Mark's version. Mark's version of Easter, Jesus creates chaos and bewilderment, and then leaves us with a cliffhanger waiting to see what happens next. Mark's original version of the Easter story, it's brusque, it's panic, it's filled with uncertainty, much like the Easter we're experiencing right now. Like the situation in Mark's original Easter, the way forward for us now, today, is unknown, it's dark, and it's scary. Likewise, the original version of Job is not the one that we have today. Instead of the reassuring happy ending that Job 42 supplies us, Job, as it was transmitted orally for thousands of years, actually ends abruptly. The way that the original ending in Job, without the redaction, ends is that God tells Job that he doesn't know which way is up or down, and Job responds, oh yeah, you're right, sorry for bothering you, and that's it. It's the way that story ends. In both Mark 16 and Job 41, the original endings are unsatisfying, so they don't wrap up with that good, snuggly feeling that we expect from the ending of a story about disaster and courage. If we learned anything from Shakespeare, dramatic epics should end either in tragedy or they should end with the warm fuzzies. Everything has an ending, be it good or bad, and this is why not the non-endings of Job and Mark made someone want to redact both these stories, because neither of them have a real ending. A solid plot line never ends with the chaotic abruptness that Job 41 and the original Mark 16 give us. So it's unknown when Job 42 or the second ending of Mark were written. It's only apparent from the writing style and message trajectory that they're actually added by different authors at later dates. And you know what? That's okay. That's okay. In fact, it's more than okay. It's scriptural. The Bible is perfect not because it's consistent, not because it's full of wise, thoughtful characters with even tempers and well-manicured responses to problems. The Bible is perfect because it's actually not those things. Characters in the Bible are often pulled from the dregs of society. They're murderers, they're cheats, they're scumbags, they're prostitutes. They're people who are shaped into becoming radical leaders. Oh, that's good to know. Thanks, Carol. You just told me that you can't see me. I'm sorry. I don't know how to look at my notes and also look at you at the same time using my phone. So that's just
You're doing fine, Irene. Just keep at it.
Yeah, sorry. Where were we at? Characters in the Bible. They are not great people, oftentimes. The leaders of God's new kingdom are often shaped into being the way they are from being in a broken, dark place. It's okay that they're not perfect, that they don't figure it out right away. It's okay that Job 42 and the second ending of Mark, or the original ending of Mark, are sort of chaotic because that's the way life is. God doesn't call us to having perfect responses to pain and confusion. God doesn't call us to know what to do when we stand terrified at the empty tomb. God doesn't call those who are educated or powerful or peaceful, but instead those who are broken, those who are lost, those who are willing to go into those dark places to understand what those dark things mean. And that is exactly why the redactions to Job 42 and Mark 16 are key to understanding the end of our story here in this time of tragedy. Redactions are important because they make a necessary change to the timeline of brokenness. Now, the overwhelming bulk of Job is simply a tale of woe and sadness. And according to the story, Job's ability to be present with the sadness without justification and without explanation is essential. The pain born of tragedy can't be bypassed or bargained away. In fact, to justify or try to explain away the sadness of Job is an insult, not only to Job, but to God. Job's friends aren't trying to help Job. They're only trying to make themselves more comfortable with his extremely uncomfortable and terrifying state. Anyone who's been around a person experiencing grief, or anyone that has experienced grief, knows that trying to explain that grief away into a little neat package only serves to make the witness feel better, not the grieving person himself. Job is a fierce and radical reminder from the very dawn of human history that grief is real and terrible and unanswerable, and trying to make it any less of those things is only counterproductive. The bulk of Job is about honoring that grief and allowing its appropriate space. Likewise, in Mark 16, the short version, we are also witnesses to a community experiencing chaos and grief in a time of war, death, and unimaginable displacement. The short version honors that space of a knowing by not neatly packaging the chaos of that moment. It allows that grief to be present. It allows the grief to be part of what we experience with Job. It allows the grief to be part of what we experience with Jesus during Holy Week. It's an unfortunate but necessary part of our human story. There's no answer that God gives us for why suffering happens, but we know that it does. We can identify with the suffering that Job experiences. We can identify with the suffering Jesus experiences. We can identify with it right here and now as we lose so many things. But as Job asks, to what end is the answerless void of suffering the end of the story? Now, the redactions to Job and Mark tell us explicitly that the suffering and chaos we experience during tragedy cannot be the end of the story. Darkness itself cannot finish a timeline because darkness does not technically exist. In physics, darkness only exists as a negative reflection of light, not as an independent entity of its own. The timeline needs to eventually find its way back to light so it doesn't keep playing on its own loop, trying to find the way out indefinitely without end. Grief may be allowed to dominate the story of our tragedies, but we also need to listen for God in that silence so we don't get lost inside of it and never find that ending. As Barbara Brown Taylor says in her book, when God is silent, silence is God's primary language. It's a space that he created for us to reflect, to cry, to stand in the storm screaming at him for answers. Silence supplies a necessary time for us to reimagine ourselves and reimagine the world. Silence supplies a necessary time for us to see the way that God sees things, because our human understanding comes across as so small and so trite in the face of suffering's deep darkness. God's silence is the music of the soul. Anyone who listens to a song knows that a song can be understood because of its ability to deliver beauty rather than its ability to deliver resolution. God's silence is the music of the soul, and in that silence, we allow our souls to hear what we could not hear before, back when explanation and reason were our primary defenses. God's silence is our time for us to listen and learn who we are meant to be on the other side of chaos and pain. And we have to find the other side of chaos and pain, because darkness cannot be the end to a story. Oh, yes, it can, you say. A story that ends bad is called a tragedy, Irene. It's literally a genre. Well, you know what? I disagree. Tragedies are never the end of a story because they're stuck in darkness. They're stuck in a non-existent void. A tragedy is not an end to a story. A tragedy gets stuck in a loop, okay? That's the difference between a tragic end to a story and a hopeful end. Tragedy gets stuck in a loop. Addiction and war are some examples of what could literally happen to any of us when we get stuck in the pain and lost in the silence. Now, there's no shame getting lost in that darkness, for it's a really easy thing to do. No one picks up meth for the first time wanting an addiction. They pick up meth for the first time wanting to find relief, any relief from that overwhelming darkness. Another example, when a refugee is left orphaned during the war, the likelihood of that orphan joining a terrorist organization skyrockets. Grief begets grief, trauma begets trauma. Tragedy is a cycle, not an ending. Tragedy is a cycle, not an ending. We get stuck in a loop of darkness when we stop looking for hope because darkness itself cannot provide an end. For this reason, the journey from grappling raw and wild through that pain is important. That pain is most of the book of Job, is most of the journey of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. Yet our redactors have a point when they inserted happy, calm endings into these stories years after the chaos of the tragedy rips through the characters in the stories. The redactions are necessary to make the story complete, because wandering in the darkness, grasping for rays of hope through a needle, or through violence and oppression, or confusion and chaos, these are not satisfying endings. They aren't endings at all, for we know that cycles of addiction, trauma, and violence only repeat themselves if they're never resolved. The redaction, therefore, is essential, and there's a reason why it's so far removed. Right now, we are in the midst of a tragedy. We have loss of life happening. We have loss of jobs, loss of graduations and weddings and funerals and birthday parties, loss of purpose and connection. There's just so much overwhelming loss happening right now. And you know what? God is silent. God is not telling us when it's safe to reopen our states. God is not telling us if or when there will be a vaccine. God is not telling us if the economy will ever recover from this. God is silent, which means we're meant to be listening. We're meant to be grieving. We're meant to be shouting in our unbridled pain that is unanswerable and genuinely unfair. We are in the bulk of the story, not at the redaction yet. But hope is belief that the redaction will someday come. Hope is belief that someday there will be an edit that makes sense of this moment of grief that we are living in now. And I don't mean make sense in terms of justifying whether or not this should have happened. It was not God's will that your brother die to make another angel for heaven. It was not God's will that you battle impending joblessness to strengthen you. No, these justifications, as we see in Job, are the fleeting words of Job's friends, not a proper ending to the story. When I say that the edits of hope that will come to make sense of this time, I mean that we can come to believe that these edits of hope can and will happen. That they can and will happen not because we deserve the pain and suffering that made us better, but because all stories need an ending. We didn't deserve this pain. We didn't deserve this suffering. There's no actual reason for it. But we do need an ending. Without a proper ending, the characters get thrown into a chasm of nothingness that destroys them. When we listen in God's silence, intentionally and deeply, about the direction to which to find that ending, that is where the edits of hope will begin to work their way into the papers of our stories. We can't write it now because we don't have the calm hindsight of understanding that necessarily comes with far-removed biblical editing. The edits happen way later because the editors have gone through the darkness, experienced it deeply, and then grew to understand the world differently. The editors sat awestruck of God's greatness in Job 38, imagining the wide expanse of God's wisdom and perfection in creating the world. The editors stood awestruck in Mark 16, watching God himself come down to experience what we experience, suffer what we suffer, and then physically show us the way through that darkness to the other side, even if they didn't know what the other side would look like yet. The editors put their pens to paper or parchment or whatever they used back then. With a hindsight that we don't yet have, they were editing in hope that was not there for the bulk of the story. There will be a redaction to the story. Newspapers and social media years from now will provide the redactions for the darkness that we're experiencing now that show us what the new world will look like as a result of this chaos. We as people of faith, we as Christians have to edit in hope to make that edit happen. The future won't look the same, and it won't even necessarily justify the grueling path that it took to get here. Yet, as we see in the redacted endings of Job and Mark, God is greater than whatever darkness that is threatening to tear us apart. God sees us in our pain, sits with us in our darkest moments, and then shapes us into newness when it comes time to do so. And we don't know what that newness will look like. We don't know what the blank pages will say. But scriptural redaction shows us that everything eventually has an ending when hope is edited into it. And the ending has to come from hope. It has to come from a place of newness. Scriptural redaction insists that light is more powerful than darkness. And someday, when we've seen that light, we will finally be able to write our own redaction. When we edit in hope, the pages will be filled with a change that brings wholeness. Every story has an ending. May we have the courage to follow the dark, silent way towards that ending by editing in hope. Amen.
Thank you, Irene. So appreciate your message. I love that phrase, editing in hope.
We shall all.